Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to The Drill Down, the business stories behind stocks on the move. I'm Corey Johnson. Today is July 8th. Well, just ahead, we're going to look at the maker of some water purifiers, which might have gotten a little frisky describing their products. And WD-40 is hotter than, sriracha. We're going to take a look at that booming business at WD-40. And our guest, Devon Energy CEO Rick Muncrief, going to help us take a look at the technological revolution in the oil patch. But first, it's sponsor time.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era, a one-stop equity platform where you can seamlessly connect to any earnings call and surface actionable insights automatically. Era's AI-powered tools will allow you to work faster and smarter. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And we hope you're subscribing to the podcast on whatever your favorite podcast platform is. But click that follow button. It'll make it easier to listen to every single show.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following @DrillDownPod and connect with us directly at our website, bizpod.net.
And I'm Corey Johnson. Welcome to The Drill Down. We explain the business stories behind stocks in a move. And joining me to help me do that is our editor extraordinaire, Ben Wilson.
Great to be here, Corey, as always.
Yeah. So let's get to it.
Sounds like fun. Corey, tell us the three most important developments in the world of business today.
All right, well, I want to start with the IPO market. We don't normally do a lot of financial stories, strictly market stories. I'm not going to tell you what the market was down less than 1% today and people were flipping out because they were and it was. But what's going on in the IPO business is notable because of, this week there's just one IPO. One got pulled because it was a Chinese listing. And the company decided not to go public, a company called LinkDoc, a company called Unicisive Therapeutics, supposed to go out this week. So it's a slow week, but it is not a slow year. Folks at Renaissance who track the IPO business, and there's a professor at the University of Florida named Jay Ritter, who also keeps track of IPOs. He is known around the world as Mr. IPO, because he's been keeping this tally for decades. He says, if you take out all the kind of financial instruments, right? The ETFs and the REITs and the closed-end mutual funds, and just look at operating businesses that have gone public. He says 191 have gone public in the first half of this year, raising $75 billion. And even if you toss out the ADRs, you've still got 162 U.S.-based firms, plain old IPOs, raising $60 billion. That is as bigger than all of 2020. And in fact, he says we are on pace to have the biggest year for IPOs since 2000 and the dot-com bubble. So that's just an incredible amount of excitement. SPACs, which we've talked about a little bit, were super hot at the beginning of the year. They've really cooled off after some accounting changes from the SEC and some notable SPAC blowups like Lordstown. But it's just interesting. A lot of companies choosing to go to the markets and get their stock traded and open themselves up to investors. And, coverage on this wonderful podcast.
Sounds like it's an exciting and popular year to be going public.
To get public and a lot of business around that. And what that means is bankers are going to be making a lot of money in the fees. Lawyers are going to make a lot of money in the fees. The PR agencies that are helping these companies get ready to go are making a lot of money in these fees. And we're going to have more stuff to talk about. Speaking of which, let's go to story number two. Air travel is back, sort of. Took a look at the latest numbers from the TSA. They check how many people go through the TSA systems at our nation's airports. And the numbers are big. Yesterday, it was 1.9 million people. Compare that to last year's July 7th, it was 630,000 people. So about, I'm going to call that three times more than last year. But we're not back to where we were in 2019. So let me first look at what we're looking at this here. So if you go back the last, call it 3 weeks, you get about 14 days where there were more than 2 million people. But by comparison, 2 years ago, every day was above 2 million, and as many as 2.8 million flying on the 4th of July of 2019. So I think the biggest difference from what we're hearing from companies is that business travel hasn't come back. Will it come back? I don't know. I mean, I, you know, the Apple model, she's back east with our kids, and she's been flying. I'll be flying in a couple of weeks. But that's all, it's basically personal travel, right? It's not the business travel. I wonder if the Zoom year that we had last year might lead to a Zoom generation and a decline in business travel for good.
Sounds like the business travel industries may have to do some innovating to encourage people to travel again.
Or they might just travel to their Zoom call and call it a day. All right, and finally, third most important business story of the day, Wells Fargo is ending, getting rid of one of their popular consumer lending products. They're going to shut down all their existing personal lines of credit in the next few weeks and no longer offer the product at all. Those revolving credit lines, anywhere from $3,000 to $100,000, were a way for a lot of investors, a lot of their customers, Wells Fargo customers, to consolidate their credit card debt, to get rid of high interest loans, pay for home renovations, avoid overdraft fees and linked checking accounts. Wells Fargo is stepping away from that business. And a lot of their customers not too thrilled about it.
Corey, what stocks are you drilling down on today?
Well, why don't we start at the beginning with Helen of Troy?
Helen of Troy trades with the ticker HELE. Shares were down 6%, but for the last 12 months, shares are up 12%. What's the story with Helen of Troy?
So I don't know if you know this company, but you know their stuff. They make stuff, consumer products, Braun thermometers, OXO kitchen equipment, Pure water filters, Revlon hair care accessories, Hydro Flask bottles. Who doesn't love the Hydro Flask, right? Stuff. Well, it turns out that some of that stuff ran afoul with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. That's right. The EPA stepped in and they sought some of the claims that, among other things, Pure water filters and filtered air products sold by Helen of Troy claims might have been a little excessive. So the company had to pull all the offending items off the shelf. And they announced this morning when they were announcing their earnings that they took a $13.1 million write-off for the cost of tossing the obsolete packaging. The products can come back on market eventually, but they had to be pulled off the shelf. And the company taking a charge for that. Now, in context, the $13 million, what's it mean to this company to take a $13 million charge? So they had $541 million in revenues, which was a substantial increase, up 29% year over year. But again, taking that charge and unable to sell some of their stuff. Here is the CEO, Julian Mininberg, talking about the interaction with the EPA and suggesting that they were not the only company whose products might have run afoul of the rules of the road.
It's our understanding that the EPA in recent years has had a broad inquiry on some areas of claims in their rules. And then only recently, I think in the COVID era, they have been investigating even further. We have anecdotal evidence from various sources that there are multiple companies affected, but we don't have specifics and certainly wouldn't name them. In our case, on the subject of claims, it depends by product. They're actually quite minor. And the reason I say this is because our products are well labeled in water, as an example. And the EPA nonetheless asked us to clarify that the Pure products don't filter microbes. For clarity, we never claimed that they did, and that has already been corrected. Nonetheless, we're going to be stickering those boxes, and those are the ones that have already resumed shipping.
So I thought that was just super interesting that the EPA is finally during COVID saying, yeah, it's a water purifier, but it's not pure water. Can't get rid of microbes and other things. Also similar products. Air filters, they had similar problems there at Helen of Troy, and kind of a surprise. It also sounded like, I don't want to be too pejorative about this, but it sounded like they didn't really have their hands around or their heads around how big this problem is or how long it's going to go on. And I think that's one of the reasons people walked away from the stock today. But interesting company selling lots of interesting stuff.
Corey, what is your next drill down?
WD-40.
WD-40. Trades with the ticker WDFC. Shares were up 0.5% today, but for the last 12 months, shares are up 29%. What's the story with WD-40?
Well, it's a story that we've talked about a lot of other companies. You know, WD-40 is kind of right up there with duct tape. It's just kind of a must-have for every fix-it situation. Isolation renovation, been driving Home Depot. It's been driving lumber prices, and it's been driving WD-40. WD-40 reported just fantastic sales growth, which they're attributing to isolation renovation. Sales were up 26% year over year. And again, sales were good last year. Sales are led by 44% growth in America, or in the Americas, I should say. That would include Canada. And in Europe, but 43%. Not so much in Asia, 13%. But they are just seeing fantastic success with people at home bothered by squeaky stuff and people buying up lots of all the WD-40 products. The company is also, interestingly, starting to raise prices all over the world, passing on their increased prices and the prices of their raw materials, oil included among them. Here is the CEO talking to us about that, Gary Ridge, talking about how they're jacking prices everywhere and they've just started.
This is really passing on the real price increases we're seeing due to increased manufacturing costs and increased raw material costs, some of which are coming from oil, but most of componentries across the world, we're seeing inflationary pressure. So across all products and mid to high single digits, depending on which country and what impact those costs are having.
So there we have it. WD-40 just having a fantastic year with that, the people spending on anything to fix up their houses and engaging in that isolation renovation.
Corey, what is your next drill down?
Let's look at a company called GAN, G-A-N, which of course is also the
G-A-N,
ticker.
GAN. GAN. Perfect. Ticker makes sense to me. Shares are up 15% today, but for the last 12 months, shares are down 36%. What's the story with GAN?
So this is a super interesting company that is in the gambling business. Specifically, they have got kind of two businesses selling to casinos. So they've got a business-to-consumer product known as Cool Bet, and it lets you gamble online. It's focused on the European market. They say they're going to bring it to the U.S. They acquired that company within the last year. And that part of their business, a B2C business, is doing so well that they came out in the middle of the quarter and said, look, we want to let you know we're not going to wait till quarterly earnings. We're just going to tell you that our preliminary financial results show us that we're selling a lot more than we thought. And that's being driven by Cool Bet, people gambling online in Europe. And they expect revenues to be a lot higher than they previously said, even when they reported earnings just a few weeks ago. And these guys have two businesses, as I say, the B2C business, that's business to consumer, online gambling focused in Europe, and B2B, which is selling enterprise software as a service for online casino gaming to licensed casinos in the U.S. And that business is growing really fast. And what's interesting about that is that they talked a lot in their last conference call about their ability to go into casinos when the casino decides they want to do something online and very quickly seize that opportunity, sell them on a platform to host their online betting. And they talked really about, I thought, just kind of a great lesson for anyone really on how do you close a deal? You close it quick. Here's CEO Dermot Smurfit talking about how to close those B2B deals and close them quickly.
It's absolutely about resourcing not just today's opportunity from our existing clients, but also responding and being able to capture these new B2B platform client opportunities that really come up for grabs in such a fleeting way momentarily before they disappear from view again, unless you are ready and capable of bringing them online within 4 to 6 months, just as we did in Michigan, where you can see us signing a contract to Wynn in September of last year and getting them live in January. And that was just one of three major client deployments. So really, it's about ensuring that we don't miss these extraordinary opportunities, and we are open for business very much so, and we expect to have new B2B clients imminently.
So very bullish, and just a real sense of urgency there to get deals and close deals. And you saw the reaction of the stock today when they talked about their other pieces of their business doing so well as well. All right, coming up next, we're going to look at the technological revolution going on in the oil field. Really fascinating interview with Devon Energy CEO Rick Muncrief.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. Era's event access and monitoring intelligence platform improves earnings season and the investor events in between through comprehensive calendar tracking, one-click event access, dynamic monitors, multicasting, and more. powered by an advanced language processing engine, which consumes some 40,000 investor events annually across 10,000 global equities. Learn more at Aera, AIERA.com. And remember to join the Drilldown on Twitter and Instagram, at DrilldownPod. Link up with the Business Podcast Network on LinkedIn, and check out our website, bizpod.net. Let us know what stocks you think we should be drilling down on.
Hi, welcome back to the Drill Down. We are joined right now by Devon Energy CEO, Rick Muncrief. Rick, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it. The question I usually ask companies, and this one might seem simple in the oil and gas business, but what do you guys do? How do you make money?
Now, good morning, Corey. It's great to be with you and your audiences this morning. Well, fundamentally, what we do is we explore for and drill wells, produce crude oil, natural gas liquids, sell into the market. And that's how we make money. And, you know, we do a lot of good for society in the fact that we're very active and, providing fuel to fuel the nation and fuel the world.
Now, you guys in particular are drilling up in West Texas focused, I would say in the Permian Basin, at least certainly that's where the focus of a lot of the investor focus is and a lot of your activity as well. How do you describe the places and the ways in which you drill for oil?
Well, what we do, I'm going to back up. Number one is just recently here, we actually closed a merger between Devon Energy and WPX Energy.
Of course.
Closed that in January this year. And the integration, the culture, everything's going together very, very nicely. I had a high expectation, but it's exceeded them. But, you know, we operate fundamentally. I'll circle back into the Delaware Basin, the Delaware part of the Permian Basin here in just a moment. But we operate, we drill for oil and natural gas in South Texas in the Eagleford Basin. And we also are in the Anadarko Basin of Oklahoma, the Powder River Basin of Eastern Wyoming, and then the Williston Basin of North Dakota. The crown jewel of our company is in the Delaware portion of the Permian Basin in West Texas and Southeast New Mexico. And fundamentally what we do is we drill, all of our wells are horizontal. In other words, we drill down typically about 2 miles deep and make a 90 degree turn and then drill up to 2 miles on average.
Yeah.
Wells, and then we will stimulate those wells and then start producing the wells. And we also have ownership in some pipeline operations, some natural gas processing plants, those sorts of things. But fundamentally, how we make money for our shareholders is through the efficient drilling and completion and production of the oil and natural gas. And certainly the Permian Basin is a crown jewel for us.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the WPX merger and how that's gone and how you've done that. Why don't we start with that even? So big deal, done at a really interesting time in the oil business where you guys, you know, really took a big gamble to do this deal. And you also, I think in one of your recent investor events, you described that there's an easy way to do a merger and then there's the other way to do the merger. And you went the other way, which is to say you didn't just buy the assets and let everybody go. You really did try to merge these two companies, these two cultures that were similar but different in some ways. Talk to me about how you did that and what pieces of Devon and what pieces of WPX you wanted to sort of bring to the top.
Well, we knew that the merger was based, if you recall, 2020 was an interesting business time, really an interesting time for society around the world, obviously.
Yeah, interesting is a kind way to put it.
Absolutely.
It was rough.
So it was rough. It was challenging for all of us. And so, but we felt like it was a wonderful time. We felt like the market did not appreciate either one of the companies to the degree that it should be. We took a long-term view and we felt like the cultures were similar enough. And we had adjacent acreage in the Delaware. We had a mutual respect of each company. I certainly had a mutual respect of Dave Hager, who was at that time the Devon CEO. And I think it was a feeling that he would say the same thing. And so it really came together quite nicely. We have some overlap in the Delaware, but we don't have as any overlap in the other four basins we're currently in. And so those were unique to each company. So you bring those together and at the current time, all five asset areas really contribute something, either free cash flow or it's a growth option But at the end of the day, Corey, it was all about the Delaware Basin. That was the thing that we felt was the driving force. We also felt like, you know, the timing was right.
It was cheap. Oil was cheap. The production was low. You know, the global economy was in recession. And, you know, if you've got some view towards the future that things are going to get better, you know, you guys really took a swing and other companies didn't.
That's right. And we felt like, you know, what I've learned in the business world, I've been in the energy business for over 40 years now. And typically, and it's probably true of most businesses and most sectors, that if you have a tendency to lean into things and be, you know, forward facing and not be back on your heels all the time, it typically pays off. You may get burned a time or two, but typically it pays off. And we certainly, this has been the case. And so for Devon, you know, we announced the transaction September 25th, and it was, I think we, you know, our equity price has tripled since last September.
Yeah.
So it's been, some of that's obviously crude oil, but I think the fact that we've been very thoughtful, and we just felt like fundamentally the market underappreciated each company. It was a great time to put the companies together. And then we could do some unique things that combined that we could not do on a standalone basis.
Such as
implement this variable dividend. We're the first energy company to implement a variable dividend, getting cash back to our shareholders. So, you know, if you think about the broader market, it's been very, very focused on growth. Well, that's not what our investors want out of energy, oil and gas today. And it is, we have plenty of oil and natural gas available. So let's be thoughtful. Let's keep cash flow strong. Pay down debt, and in our case, be able to do all of those. And on top of that, implement a variable dividend. And the concept of that, Corey, is that, you know, Devon has paid a fixed dividend for 28 years.
Like so most companies who pay dividends, right?
Yeah, so that's right. And so what we want to do is take any remaining, up to 50% of the remaining free cash flow generated from our operations, and return that to shareholders on a quarterly basis. And so, for instance, we've done that now two consecutive quarters. We're the first company to do it. We're encouraging other companies to do that. And in a broader market that I think over time will be more starved for yield, in other words, a percentage of a dividend coming back to a shareholder, it's appealing quite nicely. And we've been getting quite a few calls from, we call them generalist investors, maybe not just the pure energy investors, but energy.
Well, it's super interesting because you've seen so many companies that make business decisions based on the ability to pay the dividend, as opposed to business decisions that are best for the business, and then have a dividend left over to pay the investors. You know, and you see some companies run into real trouble because then the investor base is only there for the dividend. They don't really, you know, the long term interest of the business might not be their focus. And if a company has to cut the dividend, the investors bail, and it hurts the company.
Right. Well, that's right. So for us, I think what we have done is a nice job of threading the needle. And that is, number one, we are reinvesting in our business, but it's not even 50% of our free cash flow. We are reinvesting in our business to keep our production flat for this year. And the market doesn't want growth. We've stated that our growth cap would be 5% on an annual basis. And that would provide a fair amount of cash flow increases over time. But for us, let's get the dividend, get this fixed plus variable dividend concept. And I really think, Corey, as we reel off quarter after quarter of this, it's going to appeal even more to our shareholders and potential shareholders. You know, if you look at it from the standpoint, the other thing we've been able to do is we've been able to retire $1.2 billion of net debt.
Right.
First 6 months of the year. We could not have done that on a standalone basis, but combined.
Well, $75 oil doesn't hurt either, but
it doesn't.
You also had some spectacular production from some of these wells.
Right.
Let's talk Danger Noodle.
Yeah, Danger Noodle. So, you know, people ask me a lot of what is Danger Noodle? Well, you know, that's a slang word for a rattlesnake. And in that area down in southeast New Mexico, and it's an area I know very well, I spent most of my childhood in southeast New Mexico.
Yeah, you didn't sound like you're from Brooklyn.
No, I'm not from Brooklyn or Queens. But
Danger Noodle
Yeah, but it was a tremendous, this area in Lee and Eddy County, New Mexico, and then just across on the Texas side in Loving County is some of the best oil and gas real estate in the nation. And we felt like that was one of the things that we liked about the Devon Acreage. And Devon Acreage, which this Danger Noodle pad was on, it was located there in Lee County, New Mexico. Gosh, well over 5,000 barrels of oil a day.
Yeah, you did 5,100 barrels of oil a day for a month.
That's
which
correct.
Is just spectacular production. Yeah. And it's not a record or anything, but it's just really, really strong. And it's indication of what you guys are doing in shale and how you guys are able to get that kind of production out.
It's great. It's great geology, but it's also a testimony to the application of technology, Corey. That's one of the biggest successes. I think that a lot of people don't fully think about, because there was a time 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago when people felt that the Permian Basin was dead.
It was done.
There was no future. It had been producing oil for well over 100 years, and there just really wasn't a future. And the application, the successful application of technology has changed that. And so whether you're
let's talk about those technologies a little bit. So specifically, we're talking about is horizontal drilling, fracking. You didn't use the word fracking, but I'll use the word fracking. And the different stages in which you stimulate those wells through fracking. It's just a fascinating technological change that really has really changed the world.
Oh, absolutely. It has. We've been talking about this for about a decade. I had a good fortune of being on the first or the team that drilled the very first horizontal Bakken well in 1987. And it was really
the Bakken up in North Dakota.
And it took 30 years for us from those first wells that were drilled in Texas and North Dakota in 1987, these horizontal wells, to in 2017 be looking across the table from Mohamed Barkindo, who is the Secretary General of OPEC, and really sense that the world has been changed. The Middle East dominance for crude oil production, the calculus has shifted.
100%.
So when you start thinking about energy transitions and that sort of thing, this is an energy transition that's been going on for 30 years. I think it's really setting the stage for whatever the future may hold. But I think it's a great testimony. We applied horizontal drilling, then advanced horizontal stimulation or fracking, as you mentioned. But it's just being able to pinpoint it. And then the application of some of the big data, those sorts of things, we can come in and we're continuing to find more and more resource. And
is that through better seismic? You know, I'm really curious how you're applying AI and what that means to an oil and gas company.
Yeah, so I think in a way, seismic is a pretty good way to look at it, but it's really being able to go in and have your reservoir engineers and your geologists and geophysicists break down these individual intervals. And you may have a gross production interval of, say, 30 feet. We can get it down to, we know which is the best 2 feet to be drilling in.
And now, kidding.
Now, so if you can imagine, you're sitting at your desk in front of a laptop, and we basically can guide these wells from, you know, several hundred miles away if we want to. We have on-site drilling operations, obviously, but we're watching in almost real time where we are in that zone.
And that drill head's going through the rock.
Absolutely. So it's just phenomenal.
Wow.
For an old timer like me, I get pretty worked up about the excited.
I covered technology for a long time. I'm out here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and people ask me about my fascination with oil and gas. And I love oil and gas because on one level, it's the dumbest business in the world. You stick a hole in the ground and see what comes out.
Yeah, it's not that way.
And then complications ensue. And I just love the oil and gas industry because it's just fascinating. The applications of all these technologies is really interesting. So what is it in the computational power of artificial intelligence that lets you do a better job drilling?
Well, I think number one is the real-time monitoring. And that real-time monitoring where we can understand pressures, we can understand the physical location of a bit, and we can tie that bit location to our mapping, if you will, of the formation that we're drilling in, and we know where that real sweet spot is. We have automation on our rigs that are optimizing fuel usage. Optimizing, minimizing emissions. We're looking at things like pump pressures. You know, what are the pump pressures that actually, as you turn the bit, is the most optimum speed to be turning your bit at the most optimum place within the formation? Just think like that, and it just goes on and on and on.
And does that mean that the top drive design is really different than it was a few years ago?
Yeah, top drive has given you a lot more flexibility. And for your audience, in the old days being only 20 years ago, it's that fast, right. We really didn't utilize top drives that much. How do you say, you know, that's something that's come on in the last 15 or 20 years.
And top drive is basically a thing at the top of the oil rig that controls the speed and how much it's drilling and so on.
You have automation on there versus the old mechanical rotary table that you had on the rig floor. So, but it's the capabilities to continue to turn. You know, that's one of the things that really helped us with our capital efficiency is we have less downtime. Unplanned, problems, mechanical complications, geologic complications, and top drive has been a big part of that. It's interesting that you know about top drive, so I'm impressed, Corey.
You can take the kid out of the city.
Yeah.
So as it relates to that, also you talk a little bit in your conference calls about your relationships with the service companies.
Right.
And there are so many, and the Schlumbergers and the Halliburtons and the Baker Hughes and so on. Talk to me about those relationships and how you try to manage those with this incredibly cyclical business of oil and gas.
Sure. Well, I can tell you for our service providers, the most valuable asset they have are their people. And you have to have a grounding. You have to have an understanding with your service providers that you're going to take care of their people. And that's from a safety perspective. That's from a continuity of work perspective. And, you know, one of the challenges that we saw during the pandemic is there was a lot of panic and many people may have been running, let's say they were had 15 rigs that they were running and they went from 15 to zero. There was that right. panic. Well, that might have been the right thing for a producer from a company like ourselves short term. But if you didn't take a long term perspective, you know, what you're going to do is you're really going to hurt those service providers because suddenly they're faced with a decision. I have no more income coming in. We're not working. Do I keep my people, you know, and try to wait around and do some things and hope for the best? Or do I make the tough decision to let them go now? What we did is both Devon and WPX is we cut our activity in about half and we throttled back, but we were able to keep a lot of our core service providers working. And these are people that they're your partners. It's not doesn't have to be an adversarial relationship. We can't provide our goods and services unless they're doing the same. You know, we can't put crude oil, natural gas in the markets to meet the demands for society if I don't have service providers that are out there working and their folks are doing a good job. So we have a strong relationship. It's something we're very proud of, and we're going to continue to do that. And I think it can give you an edge up on your competition if you're viewed as someone that has the balance sheet, the liquidity, the cash flows coming in, that can continue to execute and continue to stay active. That's a big difference. If you're a service provider, that is so meaningful versus
good, going out and trying customer, to. Yeah. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about what's going on with OPEC right now with this sort of meeting that's dragging on and dragging on. Yeah. There were some suggestions from some of the reporting. Apparently, people really like to talk when they're at these meetings, talk to reporters off the record, that the UAE, United Arab Emirates, has a different view about the future of oil and that their notion is, hey, we better sell this stuff now while the world's buying. Well, and it sort of suggested that they're looking out at a future where alternative energy sources, you know, whether it's geothermal or wind or solar, might take the place of oil and that they should probably try to transition their economy right now. That seemed like such a radical viewpoint to be coming from anyone in the oil business, especially in the Middle East. I wonder what your take on that is.
Well, you know, I think I think there's an element of posturing there, Corey, where they're trying to really get their quota bumped up. And, you know, they've talked a little bit about that. So, you know, this latest revelation, if you will, about worried about a energy transition, we better get it while we can, is somewhat of a new twist. I think that's probably counter to what the way most of the OPEC plus nations are looking at things.
You think?
The biggest focus, I think, for OPEC plus and really for the global industry is what is the right approach to continue to add barrels back into the market as the demand recovers, and we're in a recovery. The demand recovery is coming on nicely. So how do you not flood the market while at the same time, really not damage the economy and having excessive crude oil prices at a time when, gosh, let's face it, you know, the economy, we're all trying to come back from what we've been facing in the last 15 months. So my perspective, that's posturing from a negotiation standpoint, and we'll see how it all plays out. That's one thing I've learned after 40 years with OPEC. You never know what to expect, and so you just need to be on your feet. And the beauty for us is, I think crude has rallied more than we thought it would. And while it's a good thing, we're not getting overly excited about that. We're going to be very disciplined, very focused, and stick to our game plan.
And we'll see what happens. I think the biggest bogey right now is jet fuel, and what's happening with business travel. Everything else seems to be roaring back, but business travel. Maybe it'll be like this. We'll be doing these conference calls on Zooms and not in planes as much. I don't know.
Well, maybe so. We'll see how it all plays. I still think that mankind, we're meant to be together. And so we'll see how this all plays out.
Couldn't agree more. Rick, I talked to you all day, but I can't talk to you all day. Rick Moncrief is the CEO of Devon Energy. We really appreciate your time today. And we'll keep an eye on what you guys are doing there down in Oklahoma.
Okay.
Up next on the Drill Down the Bite, that one number that tells us a whole lot. We did talk about Danger Noodle producing 5,100 barrels of oil a day over the course of 30 days. So the question, what is the average production of a U.S. oil well? It's less than 5,100 barrels, but the exact number... we will give you that one number that means a whole lot when the Drill Down continues.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era, a one-stop equity platform where you can seamlessly connect to any earnings call and surface actionable insights automatically. Era's AI-powered tools will allow you to work faster and smarter. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And we hope you're listening to the Drill Down every day. A lot easier when you hit the subscribe button and follow us. That way you can download every show and not miss a single episode. Hope they're all as good as this one. We hope you keep listening.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following @DrillDownPod. Connect with us directly on our website, bizpod.net.
All right, we're back with the Drill Down and the Bites, that one number that tells us a whole lot. We talked about Danger Noodle, Devon's well that was doing 5,100 barrels a day over the course of 30 days. But what's the average production of a U.S. oil well? That number, Ben, is 27 barrels a day. That's according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. So when you think about 27 average barrels a day, now that you're probably thinking about some pump jacks you see in the side of the road, those old-fashioned things that go up and down and up and down that you see in some parts of the country. But a 5,100 barrel a day well is just jaw-dropping in that context of an average well. Being 27 barrels a day.
That's about 200 times the average production of a U.S. oil well, is that right?
Yeah, just jaw-dropping. And there are wells that have done more. And it's important that it's done it over 30 days. I was short an oil scam once where they talked about their production over the course of an hour, and then they plugged the well. Well, it wasn't really telling you what it was really going to do. At that time, they said it was just too big to measure. But in any case, great stuff from Devon. Great stuff from you, Ben. Thank you very much. You've been listening to The Drill Down. I'm Corey Johnson. Ben Wilson is our editor, and The Drill Down is a production of the Business Podcast Network.